Welcome to our Veterans Breakfast Club Scuttlebutt. This is our renamed program. It used to be called the BBC Happy Hour. We're now calling it the Scuttlebutt, where we talk about all things military, veterans related. I'm Todd DePastino, founder and host here. I am founder of the Veterans Bre Executive Director of the Veterans Breakfast Club. We're a nonprofit based in Pittsburgh. We've been around now for 16 years, where we hold conversations again about the mil everything relating to the military community and veterans community. And that includes one thing that we do with the Veterans Breakfast Club, which is travel. We went to Vietnam for the first time in 2018. We just did our third trip coming back last December. And with us, we have a group of people, wonderful people, who traveled with us for 2 weeks through Vietnam. And man, was it a blast. And it was fascinating, including five veterans who served in country. We're going to be hearing from them tonight to talk about what their impressions were of the trip, of the country, of the people, what surprised them, what they liked, what they didn't like. I just want to say hello to Sean Hall, our director of programming. Hello, Sean. How
Good
are you?
evening, everyone. I'm doing great. How are you?
I think everybody's doing okay, at least if you're here in Pittsburgh, because it's a beautiful spring evening.
Absolutely.
I want to again let people know that the Veterans Breakfast Club is a nonprofit. We have been holding events for 16 years in person, online. We do this podcast, this live stream. We publish a magazine. We have sponsors, and we're very grateful to our two sponsors of our Scuttlebutt here this evening on Monday evenings, Tobacco Free Adagio Health and UPMC for Life. I'll be talking about them later. We're a nonprofit, so we get by on the generous support of participants and members like you. You could become a member of the Veterans Breakfast Club. You could donate to it by going to veteransbreakfastclub.org. And you could always also find out more about what we do at veteransbreakfastclub.org. Let me introduce Jerry Augustine, who is one of our veterans who traveled with us to Vietnam in November and December. Jerry, you're a Vietnam vet. You served in a combat, two combat units, so in the 4th Infantry Division, in the 196th Light Infantry Brigade in 1966, 1967. You did see a lot of combat there. Were you hesitant at all to go back to Vietnam?
No, not at all, because I want to learn about the history of what I fought for one thing. And as I grew older, I got to love history. And thank you for the invite. And I was so happy to go. And what I learned over there was totally amazing to me. The friendliness, just about everything.
What did you learn?
Oh my gosh, I learned that the country became so wealthy, and I also learned that the American influence is all over Vietnam, all the way up north, right down to Saigon in the south, and what it's become. Totally different from what I experienced back in the day.
Yeah, totally different. I mean, it's I think I'm looking at Jim Roberts here, one of our Vietnam veterans, and I think one of the reasons why he would not particularly care to go is because it is so different. I think you've said that, Jim, is that the place that you went to, the place that where you served, it's now a a small city. It had been a tiny village. Jerry, I as a historian, when I go to Vietnam, one of the things that I'm always looking for is trying to look past the new highways, the skyscrapers, the development, to see if I can catch glimpses of the old Vietnam. And man, there are plenty of glimpses you can catch, I think. Remnants of the war, American ba built air bases, things like that. But also, when once you leave the cities, it's not as affluent, and it's you still see some thatch roofed houses. Did you like the Vietnamese?
Oh yes, yeah. This time around, I mean, it's third generation from when I was there 57 years ago. Everyone was friendly to me. It was totally amazing.
This is Jerry's book, Vietnam Beyond. And one of the wonderful, delightful things about this book, and we'll put a link to it here in the chat, is that you brought this little brownie camera with you. During your year tour in Vietnam. I mean, I think there are a lot of our younger viewers or listeners might not even know what a Brownie camera is, but it's this once the most popular camera, inexpensive, took good pictures, sturdy, durable. You carried that with you. It's kind of hard to believe you carried that with you your whole tour of duty.
I kept it in my front canteen pouch on the right. And my mother said in the kitchen just before I left to Vietnam, you ought to take a camera with you. And I grabbed this camera right off the counter. I didn't even think about it. I threw it in my duffel bag. And when I got to Vietnam, I kept it in my front canteen pouch. And there was 12 in a roll. You had to twist it every time and look at the number in the back. And I took 200 photos while I was in combat.
Gosh, 200 photos in combat. And Jerry, we've talked about that. We talked extensively about this on the trip. And I still don't quite get how you can be serving in combat and have a camera with you. And like literally, sometimes when you're in danger, you're pulling out your camera and taking pictures.
When I think back, I can't imagine why I did that. But everything that I was seeing was so mind-boggling, I had to capture it in a picture.
Yeah.
And I handed the camera to my friend when we were going out on an ambush patrol. I had that 10-cent mirror with me. I just put on some, you can see the stick makeup before we went out on ambush patrols. We were always soaking wet. You can see my uniform, 100 degrees, 90 degrees at night. And this is what I did. And it's amazing that they're very important today, these photos.
They sure are important. They capture a little slice of life of an infantryman on patrol in 1966, 1967 in Vietnam. This thing here that looks like a kind of a large button, looks like there might be a woman's face, a Vietnamese woman's face on the reverse side. That's actually a little like makeup mirror.
Yeah, it's a little mirror. I went to downtown Tain Inn one day, and these things were for sale for 10 cents. And I just grabbed one. I says, I may need it sometime.
And you did for putting on for
Yeah.
darkening your face for a patrol.
Oh, sure.
Wow, wee. And this is a wonderful handmade map of where you served. You had the great distinction of having arrived in Vietnam by airplane, whereas the rest of your unit arrived by the slow boat, right?
Right. Yeah. I won a contest being best in my battalion. And I got to have 3-day passes for a whole month while they were in two ships heading out of Boston, the 4,000 of them. They had to go through the Panama Canal, and it took them 33 days to get to Vietnam. I landed August 4th of 66. And the next morning, they put me on a C-130 all alone. They sent me up to where the red dot is there to Tain Inn Province. And I joined the 25th Infantry Division, waiting for my unit to arrive. It took 10 more days before they arrived. And then we built the Tain Inn Base Camp. It was right on the end of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And our missions were helicopter assaults, ambush patrols, and search and destroy missions for my whole tour, my 1 year tour.
And you were kind of shot, you were shot at, you were in danger from what I believe, the first or second or third night in country.
Right. Yeah, my sergeant right next to me got shot with a carbine. We heard the pop, and it's a distinctive sound. We were going across a rice paddy, and the shot went into his canteen, and we called it the $1 million wound because he got to be taken, and he actually went home. And I was right next to him. We all hit the dirt, and the perpetrator was in a spider hole. And with a trap door. He got up and he ran back. It was a VC. And we never did see him. We never returned fire. But
It
that was
just
my first week experience.
your
Yeah.
first week experience, and there you are at 1966, exactly when the US government discovered those tunnels, the tunnels of Cu Chi, which we toured when we went to Vietnam.
Oh, yes.
And you were there with the 25th Infantry Division right on top of them.
That's right.
Remarkable. Is this what is this here?
Oh my gosh, yeah. That's probably one of the worst days of my life. I always think about it. But my sergeant put me on point with a machete, and we're going through I never got along with my platoon sergeant. So I think he did this on purpose. And I'm heading through the jungle, I'm being on point, and I came to this clearing, and all of a sudden it was just like in a horror movie. Dead silence, and all of a sudden I heard a pop, and a rifle-propelled grenade hit a tree about 5 feet from my head, and it bounced on my boot, and it didn't go off. It was a dud. And this is the bunker that they shot at me from. So they got up and they took off to the rear of it, and we were doing a push toward the 25th Infantry Division, and they shot them both with a machine gun. But that was the closest, probably, that I almost lost my life.
And when we were going through Vietnam on our trip, and we would go to these museums, some big, some small, some having a kind of a not well curated, let's say, collection of items, some very well curated. We were looking, I was looking with you for the weapon that had shot that rocket propelled grenade, and we thought this was something close. I think this was at
Oh,
the
yeah.
Ho Chi Minh Trail Museum. That's where you first told me that story. You said, like, this is it. This is the thing that shot that rocket at me. So if it had gone off, I mean, you wouldn't be here.
That's correct. To this day, I'm blessed. And it's amazing that we lost all these 58,000 plus soldiers. Sometimes I think about it, why was I gifted? Why did I come home? It's unbelievable.
Jerry, one of the wonderful things for me traveling with you and the other veterans and just the other history people who are interested in the Vietnam War is seeing these items like this. And there are so many of them because we, the United States, left everything in Vietnam. We left it with the South Vietnamese Army when we, finally left on March 29th, 1973. And so a lot of this equipment, a lot of the weapons, a lot of the paraphernalia is there in Vietnam and is kind of everywhere. And you go to these war museums and you see all this equipment that you dealt with. And it seemed like every veteran has a story about one of these things. So one of the delights is, to me, looking at this rocket, grenade launcher, it's just a mechanism. But to you have a story. You bring it to life. That's the delight for me touring Vietnam with veterans. Was it odd to go? Was it strange to go into a museum like this, a museum built by the enemy, to kind of show
Right.
how they in their mind won? Was that odd for you?
It was a little bit, but oh boy. I'm glad this stuff is out there. It's history. All our stories, every veteran has a story. I'm so glad that I joined up with you because I kept it in for 45 years. And then when I joined the vet center, I got talked into going. And I had a friend in the vet center. I couldn't even speak at first. And then when I heard these veterans talking, I said, God, these guys are just like me. And then I started to open up. This was about 2010. And then I had a feller, another veteran there, and he says, Jerry, you got to write your book. You got to write your book. And I put him off for 6 years. And then COVID came along, and I got a letter in the mail with a $20 bill in it. And George says, Jerry, this is for your book. I'm the first buyer. He says, I got to write my book. And that's the reason why I put my pictures together and wrote my book.
And that was the motivation. You got paid for it, so you figure I gotta actually do this thing.
Right.
I'm going to show another slide or two of yours, and then ask some questions from some of the other vets. But I noticed that some of your photos, many of your photos, are actually of the Vietnamese people. You with some kids, and then just kind of like slices of life in these villages when you were out on search and destroy. You actually would take pictures of the villagers and of the villages.
I always try to do the best I could, and they gave us a Vietnamese to English to Vietnamese booklet, and I was learning phrases. So anytime I went into a village, I would yell out a phrase like "Chao tui nước đã," that means "Give me some ice water," and things like that, "Chao co," "Chao dep," etc. And the children thought I could speak fluently, so they would just come running over to me, and I made friends all the time. I mean, here we are searching out the villages for weapons and things. And there's another good picture.
Yeah, such a
And
good.
it was just wonderful at the time. And you got to consider these children now are in their 60s
Yeah.
because they were only 10 years younger than I was.
That's right.
And I had an eye injury. I went to downtown Saigon,
Yes.
walking around with a patch on. And it was funny. The film was 67 cents for black and white, 80 cents for color. And to save that little bit of money, because we were only getting paid $175 a month, I bought black and white film when I was in downtown Saigon.
And this again, a little slice of life. This is our travel group here.
Yeah,
And it's
beautiful.
all, I'll share some of those photos, but the pictures of the people. So you didn't feel animosity, I guess I should say, towards the people necessarily.
No, they were all innocent people. All these villagers, they were peasants. They were innocent, when the Viet Cong weren't around or the NVA. And I felt so sad for them. I got photos of them building another hooch or another house. Here we are going into their land and into their livelihood. And it's the first time that they saw soldiers, but they went about their business. Most of them were farmers. We were always on call. We always I was in the jungle 90% of the time that I was there. Yeah.
Lou, Louis Selden, you have your hand raised. Thank you. And I do want to invite anybody who has something to say or a question to ask to raise their hand. How are you, Lou?
Good, how are you? Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Good. Yeah, I just want to comment about Jerry's book. We just dedicated a bench to a World War II veteran that I used to play dominoes with every morning in Keller, Texas at the McDonald's. And he hit 100, just I think it was 2018, about 2 months later, passed away. But I'd sit and talk to him. He was a tanker in North Africa and Italy. And he had quite a success story after he got out of the army. But he grew up, he was born in Alabama, raised in West Texas in a little town called Coleman, went in the army, served in North Africa and Italy in tanks. And I told him, I said, you need to write a story about your life. You've got an interesting life and whatever. And he couldn't talk about the war at all, but every once in a while something would sneak out.
Yeah.
Like he was sitting there one day. I asked him about Sherman's, and I said, they went over there blanking on the name, these little tanks that looked like the Japanese Tinker toys. And he was in his battalion, the 757 battalion, was in the Kazarine Pass in that scene, from the Patton. He was there, he lived it, and his friends were ones that were dug up, their uniforms stolen. But he was we talk, and all of a sudden something would pop out like he was talking about. And I was watching something on YouTube the other day about tanks, and I realized how I'm glad I was never in tanks. But he would sit there, and all of a sudden he'd share something with you out of a clear blue sky, and he said, the tank was going around a farmhouse, and I'm going to assume it was in Italy. And the Germans had a tank gun behind the farmhouse and fired through the turret, and it took off the legs of the tank commander. And the guy was, was crying for somebody to shoot him. He was in so much pain. And then he shut up. And I mean, these little vignettes that he would
Yeah.
share with us were so.
Lou, and that's kind of why we do these programs, is we want to, create a platform where veterans feel comfortable and welcome to share stories that they may not even have shared with their family members. Right? And that's why I do think, Lou, that it's so great that Jerry wrote a book and
It
captured,
is, and that he was able to do that. You know, I
and he was
you
able
know,
to.
I congratulate him for being able to do it. Okay. It's
Yep, it takes a lot of work and concentration and often dredging up memories that you'd rather, not remember. I'm going to ask, we have Rich Dorr here and we have
can
Bob.
can I can I add one other thing and I'll shut up.
Okay.
For anybody who lives in the Keller, Texas area, north in the Fort Worth area, we have veterans groups and Wednesday morning, we meet at the senior center at 9 o'clock. One of our members was a Vietnam combat medic, and I asked him to speak, and I was real glad and fortunate that he agreed to speak. You know, he had two Purple Hearts, and if anybody would have PTSD, it'd be him.
Yeah.
So anybody in the area, we have a veterans chain. You know, if you can get in touch with me, okay? Thank you for your time.
Yeah. And Lou, would you put your information here in the chat so that if there are people who are nearby and would want to join you, they could connect with you?
Okay, let me see if I remember how to do that. All
All right. Yeah. W work on that. Figure
right.
that out. All right. Thank you, Lou. Rich and Bob, how are you?
Doing fine.
I'm
What was it
fine,
like?
thanks. Hi,
Rich,
Rich.
what was it like for you to go back to Vietnam?
Well, when I was in Vietnam, I was pretty much confined to a base. So I only got outside of Phu Bai maybe five times. So all the countryside that I saw was just between Phu Bai and Da Nang and back again. I was in Saigon only for 2 days, and everything was like new to me, totally new.
You didn't see much of Vietnam when you were
No, I had hardly anything. And the beautiful spot that I was telling people about, the Hai Van Pass, is there, but there's a tunnel through the mountain now, so nobody goes up the Hai Van Pass, and that's about the extent of it.
We took this great picture outside the base where you were. This is Phu Bai. I think there was a base, like the Air
That's
Force.
the Air Force side of the
Air
base.
Force side.
And it's
Right.
now the airport that has one flight to Burma,
So
so
they
it's
call it the
international.
International Airport. Yeah. But this was it. This was a U.S. Army base during the war. And across the street was the Air Force. I'm sorry, this was the Air Force base. And then
Right.
across the street was the Army base. So this was kind of like new to you. You were seeing the country in a sense for the first time.
The only things that were familiar were driving into Hue and back and forth on that road, and the trip to Da Nang. You know, the sights are familiar and the mountains and everything, but seeing Marble Mountains for the first time, seeing Khe San for the first time, and of course Hanoi was all, you know, was new and very interesting.
What did you think of the people and the country?
I thought they were, very, very accommodating. They were friendly in all the restaurants that we went to, even the hotels. And they tried to be as helpful as possible, as far as I could see.
Yeah. Bob Ankitis, we got to a spot where you had served. You moved around a lot with the 101st Airborne. Here is Fire Support Base Tomahawk.
Yes.
And this is an unusual fire support base. These fire bases were usually way out, so remote, and they still are, so remote that there weren't even roads to them. You helicoptered in, everything in and you helicoptered everything out. This was a rare fire support base that actually was close to a road. And we were able to figure out the coordinates and find the location, and here it is.
Yeah. I guess I was on probably eight or nine fire bases in my 13 months or 12 months. And there were only three of them that were accessible by road. And this is one of them. It was right off of Highway 1. And we had trucks that ran back and forth between Camp Eagle and the fire base with daily supplies. It had a mess hall where we got something, real food, instead of sea rations. But I wasn't there very long, but it was a nice break.
And once again, this is like an example of you drive by it, you might glance at this, have no idea what it is or where it goes or what it was, but having you with us made that site meaningful. And that was a pretty cool thing, Bob.
Well, the whole trip was a cool thing for me. I really, you know, spending 24 years in the service, I did a lot of traveling around the country and our country. and overseas, Vietnam, Korea, Germany twice, and then traveled when we were in Europe to many surrounding countries. So I've done a lot of traveling, and this was probably one of the top. It might have been the best trip I've ever been
Why did,
on.
what did you like? Is it that you liked the country?
I mean, I didn't get to go places where I had been, but I got to go places where I hadn't been, and that was cities. Da Nang, Saigon. Of course, then we went in Hue. I flew over Hue many times, but never on the ground. And then, of course, Hanoi. And the most enjoyable thing for me is because I never met any Vietnamese people and was never around any Vietnamese people. The most enjoyable thing for me was meeting Vietnamese people and seeing how much they like Americans and seeing that they were having a decent life compared to all the years of war. And I really enjoyed seeing them having a communist country. Obviously, don't have all the same freedoms we have, but those people that are working those little shops on the streets and working in the rice fields, I don't know that any of that matters to them. They're happy. And, they have food and they're not wealthy, they're not well-to-do, but they have a good life compared to all the years that they and their ancestors, not so much to kids today, but when the adults and their ancestors lived in a war-torn country, and now they have peace, and I enjoyed that more than anything.
Just seeing the country at peace.
Yeah, and the people, at peace.
Jim Roberts, how are you?
Good. Could you put that last picture back up?
Let me see here.
Just as an aside, one of the things we never really show people is imagine walking into that jungle that you see with just a compass, a map, and 80 pounds on your back. Imagine spending a week in an area like that. That's what a lot of troops walked on, not the road, but the stuff you see on the left and right of the road. I mean,
That is.
that's one of the reasons I don't want to go back is I don't want to go see that because wandering through that is enough. But I mean, that's what it was like for a lot of people over there for many, many days of their tour.
You could very easily imagine walking into that thicket and never coming out. I mean, walking into that thicket that is impenetrable. You cannot move through it, I would imagine, unless you had what do you call it? Machete, something to chop away some of the brush, and you have no idea where the enemy is.
Well, the other thing also is the unit I was with, we didn't cut because if we cut, we left a trail. We tried to move through it with as little damage as possible because we didn't want to be we didn't want to be tracked or trailed. So, I mean, that's just a comment for people because that's something you don't see very often.
So that would be something you wouldn't want to see because it wouldn't bring back particularly good memories.
True.
Got it. Thank you, Jim. Peg, what was your connection to the Vietnam War?
My brother served during Vietnam. He luckily was stationed in Thailand for the vast majority of his time. From what I understand, he served on a PAC command base and was in transportation. And I also understand he was in and out of Vietnam, a minimal number of times. I think he didn't talk to me a lot about stuff, not because he had particular experiences that he didn't want to share. I think it was more of the guilt kind of thing, because he didn't serve in the rough kind of combat that so many guys did, including a couple of his really good friends, one of whom he lost. And so we joked about it though in my family over the years, because my mom's first husband was a B-17 pilot in World War II and was killed returning from a mission. So she probably prayed him into that transportation position in Thailand, so it's that was what we always talked about in the family anyway, that's why Bill had a had a better spot. But so certainly because he served. And I think a lot of folks know that Debbie and I volunteer at the MAPS Air Museum in the Akron Canton Airport area, and we are surrounded by 100+ veterans, many, many, many of whom served in Vietnam. So, this is a constant conversation, that we're always having, and the guys talking about their experiences, et cetera. So it's just an important part. It also was just so much of my youth. It was my senior year when we finally got out of Vietnam. I'll never forget the day that, I walked out of class my senior year in high school, and the guys were all standing together. And that was, the day that they had stopped the draft, because our guys in our class were ready to go as soon as they graduated. So, so that has a big impact. All of that had such a big impact on me.
So it was a kind of a shadow in a sense that's been with you your whole life because you grew up in the Vietnam era. And I also imagine that you would now come back and be able to relate maybe a little bit better, a little bit more knowledgeably with the Vietnam veterans who come to the museum.
Very much so. Very much so. Yes. I have to tell you though that I'm still in turmoil over so many things. My brother was serving, he was over there. We had a lot of family friends whose, sons were there. And so of course, I grew up in very much we're gonna love America and do what they tell us to do kind of family. And at the same time, the whole American society around me was sort of pushing in the other direction. And even the trip to Vietnam, I struggled with a lot of that, Todd, to be honest with you. It was an incredible trip, and extremely enlightening. And people ask me all the time, what did you enjoy the most? And I always have to say, I'm not sure enjoy is the word that I would use. But
Correct.
what was the most impactful to me was going to the sites where the Vietnam vets who were with us on the bus every day, and having them share the stories, 100% best part of the trip. I mean, it was all great, but just being able to be with those guys and having them share their experiences with all of us was quite memorable.
Yeah, it's not like going to a resort and hanging out at the beach, for 2 weeks. It's an adventure in a sense. And you're for me at least, it's like every time you turn your head, you see something that you have a question about. What is that guy doing? What's he smoking over there? I mean,
Yeah.
literally, what's he smoking over there?
Wait,
What are
that's
they
Bob.
eating? Right. I mean. And it really is. It's still very much a world apart, very different from the United States. It's enchanting in many ways. It's beguiling and bewildering in other ways. I'm very happy that we have Bamboo Bob himself. Rob is with us. Rob was our host for, I think, one of our absolutely highlights of our trip was in Da Nang when we got to spend an evening with you, Rob. How are you?
I'm great, Todd. How are you?
Good. I'm going to bring up some pictures here of our evening at your place. You're in Da Nang right now.
I'm in Hanoi right now.
You're in Hanoi. What are you doing in Hanoi?
I wish it's probably too much backlight there because the morning's coming on, but I'll try to walk over with my laptop later and show you exactly what you were talking about before, Todd, which was there's all these modern buildings and then there's the alleyways and the old town behind. So I'm in kind of west suburb, not really suburbs, west downtown Hanoi in a place called Khao Zai. And here it's exactly what you described, which is, they got these modern buildings, and that's just like everywhere. And then you just go down the street to a local area, and you're back in Vietnam again. It's wonderful.
You call Vietnam home, at least for part of the year. You spend a lot of time in Vietnam, live a lot of time in Vietnam. You obviously love the country, love the people. I know it's hard for you to put into words maybe what you do love about the country and the people, but can you give it a shot? I mean, what is so special about the country?
Well, I'm just so in awe of your description, which really brings it home for me. You use words like beguiling, and it's just constantly interesting to me. I grew up in Toronto, Canada. I spent a lot of time in the US, and it's all very familiar to me. And then you get to a point where I just really needed some fresh input. And so, yeah, I probably spend more than half my time in Vietnam now and a lot of time in other, like India and Turkey and the US and Canada, of course. But yeah, I just find it just so constantly engaging. Like you cannot, I just stop in the street sometimes and look around, and everything is new to me. And I came here first in 2017, and it's still brand new for me. It's amazing.
Yeah, there's always something new to learn, you know. Yeah,
Yeah.
just such a fascinating place. And I'm looking here for pictures of that evening. I'm Ray Brendel, who's on the call tonight, ran into a fellow. This is the kind of thing that that would happen. Ray, I'm looking for Ray here. Ray Brendel ran into a fellow North Side Pittsburgher in Da Nang, a young woman who I think 28, all of 28 years old, who has is opening up one of the first soul food restaurants in Da Nang, and she was in your coffee shop when we were having dinner, and it was just so cool to kind of see her. She's from Pittsburgh, and talk about what it's like to move to Vietnam and start a business.
I just sold her a motorcycle. Wonderful young black woman named Amara, and her business is successful. I have not visited yet. I can't wait to go and see it. But it's yeah, basically, down home southern cooking from Pittsburgh. So yeah, I cannot wait to visit. That yeah, it's so funny. What a very small world, Todd.
What a very small world. And what here's the picture I was looking for. And what a difference from the war years and the Vietnam that most of us are familiar. When you say the word Vietnam, you pretty much most people think of the war. But not her. I mean, she moved, there she is with Ray, and she moved to Vietnam to kind of pursue her passion and her dream, and she's doing it, and it's pretty
Yeah.
cool.
Hey, Bob,
Really
I
cool.
was just curious. What brought her into your shop that night?
That's a great question. So what's interesting about the shop, which kind of was created without my knowledge while I was riding around in Turkey, the industrious Vietnamese got ahead of me a little bit. It's got a great mixture. It draws in people because of the name, just because of the look of the place. It draws in people from the West, mainly, Americans and Brits and maybe the odd Australian and Canadian, who are all odd, as you know. And then it's got a very strong Vietnamese contingent. So I think what's common about both groups is that people like to be with the other people. If you don't want to mix it up with foreigners, let's call it, then you probably don't come to Bamboo Bob Coffee. It's a place where everyone kind of comes just to feel connected to each other. So that's what I think we've accomplished, and I'm just so in awe, I guess, of my Vietnamese partners and friends, because they had this idea for doing something, and I'm not the most creative person, and I didn't see it until it happened, and it's really a special space now.
Ray, Brendel, what did you think of the trip?
Someone used the word adventure a few minutes ago, and that's the word I'll use. It was a great adventure. Valerie and I retired right during the pandemic, and we had wanted to travel. Of course, we couldn't during the pandemic. So when this opportunity came along, it was just great. I mean, I don't have words to describe what a great trip it was. Everything about it, I absolutely loved.
So interesting. Clive and Judy, how are you?
Well, thank you.
Judy, I like your shirt.
Thank you. It's particularly good for me. It's doing me a power of good every time I wear it.
Well, Judy is a kind of a diminutive person, and I sent her like a double extra large sweatshirt that I think both you and Clive could have fitted to it, both of you. And so we swapped it out for a more appropriate shirt. What was your connection? I mean, I think people could tell by your accents that you're not native to the United States. You're not Vietnam veterans. Why did you want to go to visit this country?
Well, I'll give it a shot in a way. I arrived in Pittsburgh in 1964. So I saw the development, obviously, every night on TV, what was going on in Vietnam, et cetera, et cetera. I also had one of the draft cards. I was 5A, so that meant either for work I wasn't going to be drafted, or for age, I was 25 when I arrived. But no, I wanted to see what went on. Furthermore, people from the Heinz History Center, docents, who'd been on one of your trips before, they talk very highly of it. And that's why I wanted to go, basically, on their recommendation. And they were right. They were right. As far as impressions go, all sorts of things come to mind. I mean, Peg said it right. It wasn't just enjoy, it was appreciate. But I mean, I remember Le Jardin in Hanoi. We'd been in this sort of posh hotel, and opposite, squatting on her haunches, would be a woman with a bag of eggs, selling eggs, you know? And a contrast to that would be in Saigon, you could see where the last helicopter left from one particular place. It was on the TV all the time. Next to it was a department store that I couldn't afford to buy stuff in. I mean, it's just out of this world, you know, very, very extremely expensive. So that there were all sorts of contrasts, as far as I was concerned, in the visit. Obviously, it was made by having the veterans with us to give us some background information, etc. Khe Sanh, for example, you go to Khe Sanh in the mountains, you can see Laos in the background, etc. It was a meadow, basically a meadow with two rusting tanks, several airplanes or helicopters and that, but you didn't know what the hell, you know, what hell it was there for about 5,000 soldiers and the Vietnamese surrounding them, people on the hilltops, fire bases, etc., etc. Unless you had some background information, it wouldn't mean that much. I also remember they had a sign of progress, a wind farm next to it. So Khe Sanh. And then you go for the bus and there's a small place selling coffee. Excellent coffee drink in for about 40 cents, whatever it was, but very enjoyable. And of course, the group, the people in the group were great. And I particularly enjoyed the repartee between Bob and his friend Nick. They'd known each other as children. They were both Vietnam at the same time. But to sit with them at breakfast and listen to their stories was just great. I mean, it was high humor, whatever. So it was most enjoyable. And I hadn't realized just how big the population is now. It's 100 million, whereas during the war, I think it was more like 30 or 40 million. Hanoi, Saigon, both 10 million, both with about 5 million motor scooters, which were extremely dangerous. But, you know, all sorts of memories that I have anyway. So I don't know, Judy, whether you have anything to add in addition, but it was a great trip.
Well, our connection with you, Todd, starts off when you came to a book discussion on the book that you had written on the cartoonist. And you talked about Vietnam then. And you'd given a talk about Vietnam and the Breakfast Club a couple of times, and we'd listened to you. And this discussion of going to Vietnam with a group really caught my fancy. I thought I wanted to go out to the Far East. I'd not been out that far east to live or anything. So I felt that would ease some of my angst to go to other places. And then when we got there, the group was fabulous. It really was. Humor, seriousness, past discussions, present discussions, everything was covered. And it went very, very quickly. You introduced the history of Vietnam right at the beginning, and we really began to understand how ancient it is and how they've been surrounded by war so frequently and come out of it and moved on. And the Vietnam War, and they call it the American War, of course, has done that yet again. They do have the full support of America, which has helped them move forward. They have the shadow of China to the north, which is troubling them a lot, and they are concerned about. But for us who had never been there, you took us through and showed us so many places that we would never have gone if we'd been on our own, and there wouldn't have been the significance of and the shadow of the war of it all. But you were talking about the undergrowth and the fear of going through that. The one place I really felt fearful was in the canoe down on the river. And we got into these long, heavy canoes, and then were paddled through the water in complete silence, mud high on either side and palms above us. That's right. And that is where I was frightened. I could feel the fear of people serving in the country there, because you knew the other side were traveling with no shoes, they made no sound, and you wouldn't have a clue until you've been hit. So that was an experience I will never, ever forget. But through and through, we had a wonderful guide to take us everywhere. Tan spoke such good English, sense of humor, and we never failed to enjoy each day. And I thanked you every day, too. So it was very good, Todd.
Judy, it was. Would you mind telling people briefly how you grew up, where you grew up? Because although you have what we would call an English accent, you don't consider yourself really completely English because you grew up in India.
I'm an American, Todd. You forgot.
Yes, you are. You're an American, absolutely. But, however, your girlhood, your childhood was in India, correct?
Yes, I was born in India, up just in the foothills of the Himalayas. And the reason I was born there, my father was serving. He'd been to Sandhurst, which is the equivalent of
West Point.
Thank you, West Point. And so it was the First World War ended, as he was coming out of training, and they didn't want many more in the army. So if he wanted to stay in, he went therefore to India to serve. And that was the ultimately the Indian army. It was the sort of run by the British, but in the army were quite a number of Indian officers as well. So my brother and I were born there. He was 6 years older than I, so he remembers huge amounts, loved every moment of it. He started speaking some Hindustani. I was too small to be doing that. When the war ended, I was 5, and ultimately we got to England. And I say ultimately because my parents were born in the West Indies and there was a problem. But then I was English from then on. But I remember parts of India, to me, very clearly. I can draw a map of the house we lived in at the end and so on. And the colors, it was the colors that I picked up again in Hanoi. I found the vibrance of the color and the distinction between ordinary and flamboyant very, very marked. It was an experience that I'll just never forget. But you talked about the modern hotels, the wealth of these hotels. And when we stayed right at the very beginning, on the opposite side, we had a front room. There were those little shacks just opposite us. And I took several photos of those because of the contrast one with the other. And it happened time and time again.
Yeah, just amazing. Nick Ettinger, how are you?
Fine. How are you, Todd?
Good. I'm going to show a great picture of you. Hold on a second. You and Bob. Here we go. Let me find it. I have so many open windows on my computer. Oh, geez. I'm going to have to. Hold on a second. I got to find this thing. Oh, here it is. I see it. There you are. What a cute little kid. What a cute little kid you were. There's Bob and Kytus right there. And this is Nick, I think, correct, right?
Yeah, that's me.
And this is a third friend of yours?
Yes, he was a good friend of ours. We learned after we returned home from Vietnam that he was a Marine aviator, and he was also stationed in Da Nang down around Red Beach for most of his tour. And Bob and I only learned about that after we got home.
And he made it back?
I'm sorry, what?
This man made it back?
Yes, he did.
So the three of you grew up together and you all served in Vietnam?
Yes, we were all there at the same time.
Wow. And I should let people know that, you know, you and Bob have been friends ever since. And it's kind of like you have a brotherly relationship. And Nick, I have a brother. And when we get together, we just start like hitting each other and you know, putting each other down and making fun of each other. And that was kind of like what you and Bob were like on the trip.
Yeah, We've been like that all our lives. You revert back to your, even though we're like right. 78 years old now, we revert back to kindergarten, fifth grade, that time period when we get together.
It, you know, one of the, you were stationed in Da Nang, and I like to, one way I like to refer to your job is that you had referred to yourself as the Sam Walton of Da Nang. You were in supply logistics, first logistical command, and it, you know, pretty good job, I would say, and also important job. And so what was neat is You and several of the travelers said that they wish they had spent more time in Da Nang, because Da Nang, and here's a picture of Da Nang that I was looking for. This is a picture from when you were there, and you could see that this is just a beautiful beach location with an airbase near it. What a waste of real estate.
That whole area from the mountain in the back is what's known in American language as Monkey Mountain, and then the on the other side to the right was Marble Mountain, where we had stopped on our trip along Highway 1, down from Wei and Fubai to Da Nang. But this whole area, which is probably about, I'm going to think, say somewhere between 10 and 15 miles between that mountain and Marble Mountain. That was pretty much back in the 1960s and early 70s, that was pretty much all American infrastructure, all military. And the thing that I found so amazing was I was expecting to see some of that infrastructure still in place when we got there. And much to my amazement, it's all gone, pretty much. I mean, there's a few things, like we saw those revetments at the Da Nang Airport. But other than that, I didn't have an opportunity to see anything that resembled the time that I was there. And it was just, I mean, I was totally amazed that whole 10 to 15 mile stretch of beach area was absolutely gorgeous. And it's like a clam shaped, it's like clam shaped, and it's all beautiful white sandy beach and beautiful blue water. And I don't know how many resorts are there now, but there must be 40 to 50 at least. And many of them are rated 4 and 5 stars. And unfortunately, we didn't have a chance to stop and look at any of them. But where we did stop, we went to our hotel in Da Nang. It was close enough to walk to the beach. It was maybe 3 or 4 block walk, and that area where we were on the beach was back in the 60s was known as China Beach. And you probably remember the movie that was, or the TV show called China Beach, which was sort of a takeoff on that location and whatnot. But as best I could tell from where we were on the beach there, I think the name of that the beach is called Ankay, Ankaye. You can sort of see it there. That's Monkey Mountain in the background on the left there. And I don't know who this guy is. He looked like he photobombed our picture. But there's Jerry and Bob and me and Peg. It was just a delightful experience to be there. And unfortunately, it was later in the evening and it was getting dark, so you really couldn't see the beauty of the beach as it would be during the day with the sun out and everything. But as I looked toward the Marble Mountain area, and all you saw were high-rise hotels and beach resorts all the way up there. And right now it's a tourist mecca. And this has all pretty much happened in the last 20 years.
Last
The
2 years.
development, if we'd have taken this trip back in the 80s or maybe into the 90s, maybe a lot of that North American infrastructure might have still been in place. But today there's really no sign of it whatsoever. And as was said before, I think Rich mentioned that, he was pretty much confined to his base in Fubai. And I had the same experience in Da Nang. I didn't really, we weren't there on
on a tourist mission, so I didn't get a chance to do much traveling. I did get to Saigon for 3 or 4 days, but other than that, you know, my whole experience relating to the country and the people and the culture and everything was strictly, you know, domiciled along the beach area or that you just saw. And but compared to the other guys, you know, I felt very fortunate because, yeah, in my job, I had 62 Vietnamese employees. And that was fantastic because I had a chance to interact with them on a daily basis. And even though a lot of them, or most of them, couldn't speak English, we did have an interpreter, and I was able to learn things about the Vietnamese people and how they lived and whatnot, you know, through my employees. And what a great experience it was. That was like I tell people, that was really my first real job in life. And after a year of that, it was something we never forget. And the other thing about this trip was, number one, what made the trip so great was having you there, Todd, to educate people about the history and history of the war, history of the culture of the people, and whatnot. And I know when I got home, when we came back from the trip, my mind was like a mush ball, that trying to remember what I had seen, what I had heard, all the stories that you told, and the stuff that our tour guide Khan had mentioned to us. I mean, it was almost too much to comprehend in 2 weeks.
It's a lot.
But, you know, I mean, I've put together a slideshow of my own, right? Thanks to contributions from Peg and Rich and some other folks who sent me some pictures and movies. And on the one slide, I wrote a trip of the lifetime. And I can't sum it up any better than that. I mean, I don't want to be redundant and talk about all the other stuff that everybody else talked about, because I agree with all of it 100%. But what a fantastic trip. And I, you know, if anybody that's on the program tonight ever has a chance to, an opportunity to take this trip, I highly recommend it. It would definitely be all worth the time.
Bill Confer, I know you have your hand up and with a question or a comment. And before we get to you, I do want to let people know, again, this is the Veterans Breakfast Club Monday Night Scuttlebutt, where we're talking about our trip to Vietnam in November and December. We do this every Monday night at 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Eastern. We'll be here next Monday, April 1st. This will be an unusual program with Beth Ruschel, who is, first of all, an expert at doing research in military records for veterans and their families. But more than that, she's a dogged researcher. She's one of the most determined. If she were a, well, I can't say that. That would not be appropriate to say. She's like, you know how a terrier just, you know, will not let something go? If she gets an assignment to do research, she just digs into it until she finds something. So I asked her if she'd be willing to come on and talk a little bit and answer some questions about how do you even begin to do research into veterans in your family. So she's going to come on, talk about the research she does. And she is doing a big research trip to St. Louis, to the National Personnel Records Center there. And she's going to spend a week or more researching. And she's offered to do some research for our folks. So we're doing a raffle. If you buy a raffle ticket, we're going to spin a wheel in the program a week from tonight. And three or four people are going to win and have their research subject handed off to Beth. And she's going to do research there in the National Record Center in St. Louis for you. So you can go to our website, veteransbreakfastclub.org, go to events, and get the link to the event next Monday night, April 1st, and also to buy a raffle ticket. And then we don't have a Greatest Generation Live this week because Vietnam Veterans Day is on Friday. So we're not going to do an event on Thursday night, but we are going to be back with our World War II programming Greatest Generation Live on Thursday, April 4th, and we're going to have Les Schrank join us. Les was a ball turret gunner in a B-17 with the 8th Air Force. He was shot down during Big Week, February 1944, and held as prisoner to the end of the war. And boy, does he have a story to tell. He lives in Minnesota, and you know, we've all heard stories about ball turret gunner. Jerry Augustine, his uncle, was a ball turret gunner also in the 8th Air Force. So that'll be Thursday, April 4th. We'll let people know about that. I want to thank Tobacco Free Adagio Health for underwriting this program. They are a wing of Adagio Health, which serves mainly women and families and health concerns. And Tobacco Free helps to educate people about the hazards of tobacco use. They advocate for healthier places to live, work, and play. And they help to prevent smoking and tobacco use. If you look to quit, you could use their quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW, or you can learn more at tobaccofree.adagiohealth.org. UPMC for Life is another one of our great sponsors. They can help you make sense of Medicare, and you can get the answers and information you need, such as how to choose the Medicare Advantage plan that's right for you. UPMC for Life has plans designed for veterans and by veterans that can save you money and get more benefits. You can view all your plan options by going to upmchealthplan.com/Medicare. That's upmchealthplan.com/Medicare. They will also be sponsoring many of our in-person events. I want to let people know our magazine is out. This is our spring issue of VBC Magazine. Most people should have received it in the mail. If you don't receive it in the mail, if you haven't, it's because we don't have your address or we have a wrong address. So let us know if you'd like to receive. It's a free magazine. We have wonderful stories in there, including a travelogue of our trip to Vietnam is in this issue here. Vietnam travelogue. You can see it right there on the cover. Email me at todd@veteransbreakfastclub.org if you'd like to get a copy of VBC Magazine. And then finally, we have a survey, 3 simple questions. It takes on average 2.5 minutes to complete. What did you like about this program? What did you dislike? And how could we improve? We really read these closely, and it helps us to kind of tweak and adjust our programs. Also, we get good advice for leads even on future subjects, topics, and guests. So please do take the survey if you get a chance. All right, I'm going to go to Bill Confer first and then Mary Klepper. Mary, long time no see. Good to see you. Is Bill still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Hey, how are you?
Thanks,
Bill.
Todd. Appreciate the time. I have a real quick story. And I'd also like to ask Jerry a question. When I first got to Vietnam, I came over with two other helicopter pilots, and we came into Cu Chi, and the battalion commander asked us, he said, well, two of you are going to stay here at Cu Chi, and one of you has got to go to Tay Ninh. Now, who wants to go to Tay Ninh? And of course, Jerry knows what a wonderful place Tay Ninh was back in 68 and 69. So we all said none of us wanted to go there. So he said, well, we'll flip a coin and the odd man goes. And sure enough, the guy that went up there never came back. He didn't make it through. The flare went off in his aircraft and they just flew into the ground. But what I was wondering about with Jerry was whether or not he had the opportunity to fly with the Crusaders, which was our sister company up there, or the Hornets, which was my company in Cu Chi, the 116th Assault Helicopter Company.
Let's see, Jerry. I'm scrolling through.
He might have left by now.
Sean, do you see Jerry?
He's muted. No worries. Yeah, he's muted.
Yeah. Oh, Jerry's here. Hold on. I'll ask him to unmute. He's here.
There we go. Yeah, I was there a little bit early, 66 and 67, and I came home August 4th of 67. And I don't remember the helicopter units that were flying us around, but I was in them. All the time. We were backing up the Big Red One and the 25th Infantry Division and the 1st Cav. So we were hopscotching all over the jungles then. So I don't really remember the units that they were from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think our unit got there maybe late 67. Anyhow, at a later time frame, he might have missed Jerry. But right. It probably would have been the Little Bears that Jerry flying you from the 25th Division.
Yeah.
They were the 25th guys.
I took a picture of Jerry by a Huey on, this is a caisson, but this would have been what you flew, Bill?
Yeah. Yeah, we flew the UH-1D, the Delta, which because we were in an area just south of Neuilly Badin, Black Virgin Mountain there, that was the only mountain we ever had to go to. It was above, sea level. Most of our landings were in rice paddies and in jungle. And so we didn't get to fly that much up north. I went up to Pleiku one time and got to see Cameron and places like that. But I wasn't welcomed too well when I got to Pleiku. They were mortaring the aircraft as soon as we got in there. And so we got back out and went down and stayed overnight in Cameron. But that's pretty much what we did right there.
Yeah, I took this picture when we were mounting the helicopters. We were going on a helicopter assault mission. Yeah.
That's what we did. We worked mostly with the 1st Division, the 25th Division, and the 196. That they were down near Saigon when I got there. And we used them and the 173rd a little bit too.
Okay.
And, just everything around the Coochie area, pretty much.
We just got back from a 30-day mission, and they picked us up with a Chinook helicopter. It could take our whole company.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. I turned around real quick, and I took a picture of my buddies. That's Dale Remelong from Michigan. And I know these other fellows, too. We lost this fellow back here. He got killed on an ambush patrol. And a good friend of mine. He was from Colchester, Connecticut.
Yeah.
And he got killed December 12th. So you can imagine what his family felt on Christmas Day.
I flew over a quad 50 right at the end of the Tainan airfield when I was taken off one day. They were just across the border, and I just must have been right on the borderline after I flew out of Tainan. And lucky for me, there was nobody sitting in the gunner's seat because I was 50 feet above it. And that would have been a disaster. But that's all I have, Todd. Thank you very much. I appreciate your show tonight. It's very interesting.
Thank you for joining us. Mary Klepper, how are you? Long time no see.
I'm great. I went into work early today so I could get 11 hours in on tax season so I could be home to, I didn't want to miss this one. Of all of them, I didn't want to miss this one. So I'm so happy to see all of our friends. I think about you guys all the time. What we made a little family on that bus. We really did. I think about my buddy Terry sitting in the back of the bus. And I was thinking about Kathy Jo the other day, wondering how she's doing. But a couple of things I wanted to touch base on real quick. One, today is Maryland Day. We celebrate the 390th anniversary of the Ark and the Dove landing on Maryland soil, the first settlers. It's also Medal of Honor Day, the 161st anniversary of the presentation of the first Medal of Honor. Today is 1 year that I climbed Mount Sarabachi and stood at the top. So, one of the things I wanted to talk about our Vietnam trip, I will go again, Todd. Let me know when it is. I'll go again. No, even double thinking about it. We were so fortunate the way our trip was set up, not only to have you to explain so much of the history ahead of time, you know, with your I call them our school lessons, but also on the bus, because many of you know I do what Khan does for a living when it's not tax season. And I talked to him several times and, you know, off the microphone, so to speak. And our trip was very special from all other Gate One trips. And really, as I looked around other itineraries, because he doesn't even go to those places with other Gate One tours. That was strictly for us, because Gate One and Trafalgar and who knows whatever, you know, any other company that goes there, they go The only thing they do is they do an option to the Coochee Tunnels and the option to do the canoe in other than that, everything is to look to the future, and they don't really have like a lot of free time. So there's no going to the War Remnants Museum, there's no going to the Hanoi Hilton. They only do that if the people, when they get to Hanoi, if they stay an extra day or they come in a day early. So we were extremely blessed that you've put all these wonderful things on this tour. And even though you kind of go in and there's a little propaganda here and a little propaganda there, and you know, they're going to tell the story, history is written by the victors, right? It's still very emotional to see anyway. And so when I talked about this trip with other people, they're like, I didn't get to do that. And I put out advice about traveling in Vietnam on a couple of websites that I'm on. And this one woman, she said, how does my husband get to go? He wants to go, but he doesn't want to go with a group. He wants to go with other veterans. So I told her about the VBC. But I don't think people can really truly appreciate how different this tour was than just a regular tourist trip to Vietnam. And so I stand here today, well, sit here, thanking you profusely for just such a wonderful job and getting Khan again. And I hope he's always your guide for as long as he's doing it.
And Mary, you and I found out at the same time that the Vietnamese aren't really thrilled with having Americans go to the War Remnants Museum or the Ho Chi Minh Trail Museum or these places where Americans are depicted in a negative light, or, you know, or the horrors of the war are
right. It's almost like they're a little embarrassed by it, I think.
They kind of, you know, they need, they want such a close relationship with the United States that they don't want to dwell on the negative aspects of the past.
Correct. And
you really do have to kind of ask.
Yeah.
Places.
Well, and the other thing that I noticed too is, I don't know if you noticed this, but Ho Chi Minh and the Ho Chi Minh Museum, the Ho Chi Minh Trail Museum, a couple of those places, as soon as we were done, the lights were out and they were closing up. I don't know if you noticed that. There was no other people there.
There was nobody else there.
There was no, I mean, not even Vietnamese people. It was nobody there. You know what that is? That tells me that that's part of, and I found this very fascinating. That's part of the communist government, part of their society. But yet, as I'm walking, one of the things I like to do, I got a free time, I went look for the apartment, you know, where the helicopter took off. And after that, I kind of put my phone in my pocket and started wandering. I was happy to get lost. But, you know, how lost could I get? I got my GPS with me.
Right.
And I thought, okay, I've gone a little too far. Let me see where I am. And I look up and I'm staring at a Popeyes and I realize I'm in the McDonald's parking lot. And you're not going to have that in a communist country. So I was like, what's happening? And then, you know, when I got really lost, I sat and I had a tea at Starbucks. So it was so bizarre, but you were so right how it's the communist government with a capitalist feel, because Ho Chi Minh's idea of communism was not like the communism we have today in the Soviet Russia and China. Right. It's so different, you know, but it was, I can't wait to go back. Can't wait. I'll go with you guys.
Thank you, Mary. I will let you know. Absolutely. Would love to have you. And it was great. It was, you know, having another interpreter like you, historian like you, to, you
know, I learned so much.
You had been to other places and could make comparisons.
Yes. Yeah. There was Ira had a question in the chat for Bob Ankitis. Am I pronouncing that last name right?
You did.
Wow. Hey, feather in my cap. Bob, Ira noticed that you were in a scout uniform, and he wanted to ask how far the scouts, or if any scout skills, aided you while you were in Vietnam.
I don't think so. I was in a Cub Scout uniform in the next show. And, you know, I was just something we all did when we were young. We joined the Cub Scouts. And
did you only go to, how far did you go in the Scouts?
Nick and I both, we did Cub Scouts. Then we did, and all of our friends, then we did the Boy Scouts. And then when we got, I think in about ninth grade, there was no Explorer Scout unit in the part of town where we lived. I don't even know if there was one in the town where we lived. And so we got permission to start an Explorer Scout troop, and we got permission from the local Presbyterian church to hold our meetings there. And so we really, both of us, went up through the Scout. I got to tell you that we were not the model Scouts. Nor were our units, the model units. Our Explorer Scout unit that we started was more like a fraternity than a scouting unit. But nonetheless, we, you know, we did all that, and it was a lot of fun. And we probably learned some skills that helped us somewhere along the line.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob.
And this is a great picture of you and Nick, Bob and Nick, when they met up in Vietnam during their tour, which is so cool. I believe this was in Da Nang. Nick gave Bob a bunch of steaks and other things that he couldn't get where he was in the fire bases. And Bob, you were very grateful for that, I'm sure. I'm looking at other people who are on the trip, and I'd just like to invite them to talk about it if they'd like. Brian, it's so good to see you. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, sir?
Good. You could tell by the sir that Brian is a veteran, Army veteran, and now you live in the Philippines. What'd you think of the Vietnam trip?
Worst trip of my life. No, I just It was amazing. I mean, really amazing, because there are a lot of expats here who travel to Vietnam, but they just go to one city, you know, and hit the bars and the club scenes and just drink. So for me, it was just unbelievable going from top to bottom. It was just great. I mean, really great. And then having, you know, veterans who actually served during that time was just a bonus. I mean, I'm with Murray. I'm already signed up for the next trip. Just let me know. Just let me know. And then when I came back to the Philippines, I did read Jerry's book. Man, what a life. What a life. I am so thankful to have met you. I mean, incredible.
Thank you for that.
Really. I mean, everybody on the trip was just so... It was family. I mean, it was really family. I had a great time. I really had a great time. So thank you so much. Yeah.
And I have to say, Brian, that one of the great things about the trip is not just seeing Vietnam, but really spending the time with the fellow travelers who, you know, the only reason you would go with the Veterans Breakfast Club is if you were interested in the veteran stories and the experience, and you wanted to learn something, and you wanted to, you know, to connect with veterans. So it was like, that was the family feel. You know, people have said with our Veterans Breakfast Club events that it's kind of like a family reunion. And I think that's what happens when veterans get together and they start swapping stories. And you being a veteran yourself, I think made the trip, you know, more meaningful than it would be otherwise.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I had a great time. It was really nice.
Val, I see Val Brendel is with us. How are you, Val? If you want to chime in, feel free. I just want to make sure if you have something to share about the trip, something that you liked or didn't like. What didn't you like, Val? What did you not like about Vietnam?
The cold shower.
That's right. Yeah, you were plagued with a cold shower in Hanoi, was it?
Yeah, our first hotel.
Yeah.
I did the Navy shower. I soaped up and then rinsed off. It was like a minute and a half.
Is there anything else you didn't like? Because there were things.
That was it.
my thing that I really didn't like was, and that surprised me, was how bad the air quality was in Hanoi.
Oh, that was surprising, especially the Hai Long Bay. I was disappointed that the air quality was bad there.
Yeah.
Because it was so beautiful.
Really bad, because it is so beautiful. And the air quality is like, and you know, I mean, we're in Pittsburgh, and we know what bad air quality is, and you could feel it. You could almost feel, you know, the pollution in the air. And the other shocking thing was to go to my, you know, the weather app to see what the air index was, and you couldn't access it. So my conspiracy theory was that, you know, it was being blocked because it was reporting the truth about the bad air quality in Hanoi.
But the thing I liked the best was the people. And the first, I think it was the first evening having dinner in the Vietnamese family's house. That was probably the best of the whole trip, if I had to pick one thing.
Having this wonderful boy, this wonderful child who spoke such, who's learning English, and he spoke such good English, and he worked so hard to explain to us how the shrine worked, how the family shrine worked, and why there's a Coke can on it, and why there's fruit, and who these people are here, and you know, and how they you know worship their ancestors, and it's an important part of their day. It was just so great to get the lesson from a young boy who really his dream, he said, is to go to the United States sometime. And he's certain that he will. Pretty cool.
And that he learned English from video games. I loved it when I asked him that. I said, "You know, you speak English so well. Did you learn it in school?" And he said, "A little bit, but mostly from video games."
Wow.
And Tom and Jerry, they like the cartoon Tom and
Yeah,
Jerry.
Tom and Jerry. Yes. Whoop.
I'm looking at others. If we have other travelers who want to, Gerald Bristol, if you want to unmute, please do feel free, Colonel, to do so. I know Deb Bussinger also is on. Feel free to chime in. Ken Embers, you did not
Hi,
go on.
Kyle.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
You did not go on the trip, but you were there in Vietnam when we were there on another trip because you work with, I imagine you've been to Vietnam many times.
Yeah, I've been there about 10 times.
About 10 times. You do the Vietnam Library Project.
That's right. Yeah, we built several libraries there. The one that's most interesting to me, I was a helicopter pilot with the 61st Assault Helicopter Company at LZ English, and we built a library there in Bong Son nearby. It's north of Quy Nhon and south of Da Nang, south of Quang Ngai. So we go back every year, and I go back sometimes and teach English there. And we travel to the libraries. We built about Libraries of Vietnam. It's now called Libraries International,
Children's
but
Library International.
Children's Library International. But it's real interesting to go back and interact with people. And I know several people, Peg and other people have said, and Val, it's so great to be with the Vietnamese people. And it really is interesting. And we love going back there. My wife and I went back for 3 weeks last time when you guys were there, but we didn't get to meet up, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think it just our paths just didn't cross.
Yeah.
We weren't able to make it work, unfortunately. What is it that you like about Vietnam and the people?
Well, for one thing, you know, the Vietnamese government had this visionary program called 2020. They wanted everybody to learn English by 2020. And so everybody does want to learn English. You talked about the young boy that did, and I am a certified ESL English as a second language teacher. So I teach teenage kids that wanting to take the IELTS, the International English Language Test. On Zoom, I teach a couple mornings a week for a few hours and teach different kids. And everybody wants to learn English in Vietnam, so it's really interesting. All the kids, you know, when you walk around Hanoi or Saigon, they come up to you and want to practice English. So it's the people that are really interesting. And several people have commented about it being a communist government, and they say, "No, we're a socialist government." I said, "Well, you can say you're socialist, but you know, did you ever notice that all in your newspapers, all the news is good? You know why? It's censored." And so there's a it's a one party country, but it's a capitalist country too, and so that's really helped them. So it's fun interacting with the people and getting to know talking with kids that are in their teens, getting ready to go to college. You know, you learn a lot. I always learn more from the kids than I think they learn from me.
How wonderful. Jeff Hurd, speaking of wonderful, you gave a wonderful presentation on our trip recently. I was going to ask if you wanted to share some of your insights. I know that I'm looking at the clock. It's 8:31, but is there anything in particular, Jeff, that you think people should know about Vietnam?
Well, it's a wonderful and interesting place to visit. I'm of the age where I was at military age during the war, but I'm not a veteran, did not serve, but I was many friends that did, and was glad to have the opportunity not only to go there and see it, but see it in the company of some Vietnam era veterans and UTOD and Khan, our guide, who really just painted such a complete and interesting picture. I'll just say, you mentioned my presentation. I started it off with a video. We were at the Rex Hotel in Saigon on the rooftop bar, which was during the war apparently a gathering place for the elite American and State Department and military people, where they would quaff a few beers, I guess, before they went home for the evening. And in 2023, in December, we were up there, and they had live entertainment, and a young Vietnamese woman stood up, accompanied by live music, and sang the Carpenters' song "Top of the World" in perfect English. And the point being that of all the things that I thought I might see in Vietnam, that wasn't one of them. And and I looked it up. That song was released just in the last year of the Vietnam War. And I'll just pile on being with all those people. It was just wonderful. Yes, the right term is like a family. And this is a family that formed in the course of a very short period. And along the lines of, it's a small world. I prefer to say it's a big village. I find out that I spent my teenage years in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and the house I was living in there was just a few blocks from where Bob Ankitis lives now. So,
help me. Thank you so much to everybody who joined us tonight, and especially to those who traveled with the Veterans Breakfast Club and shared your impressions of the country and the trip and the people. Man, that 90 minutes went very fast. Very fast conversation. I'm looking forward to getting together. I'm going to send everybody out a note about maybe getting together, have a reunion dinner sometime, some good Vietnamese food. Those who live in Ohio might be able to make it. If you have plenty of notice. So we'll be looking to do that. Take care, everybody. Have a good rest of the week. I hope that you'll join us if you live near Pittsburgh for our Vietnam Veterans Day event at the Heinz History Center at 6 p.m. on Friday. If you can't make it, we hope you join us online for that event. We're sending out, I think we're up to about 400 welcome home bags to Vietnam veterans. Have a good week. Have a good Vietnam Veterans Day if I don't see you on Friday. Take care, everybody. Good night.
Thank you, Todd. Thank you.
Thank you for watching this episode of The Scuttlebutt. I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Tobacco Free Adagio Health. Tobacco Free Adagio Health has been supporting the podcast for quite some time now. We've been so pleased to be supported by them. They are dedicated to reducing and preventing tobacco use and getting the word out about the hazards of smoking and secondhand smoke. They're all about health, so they want people to quit. They have classes, nicotine replacement therapy, and a popular quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They also educate people, children especially, about tobacco use from cigarettes, cigars, pipes, chew, snuff, and other nicotine products like vaping. And finally, Tobacco Free Adagio Health advocates for public and private policies that ensure healthy places to live, work, and play. You can learn all about what Tobacco Free Adagio Health offers at tobaccofree.adagiohealth.org Or you can check out the two Scuttlebutt episodes that featured tobacco-free Adagio Health. We had a wonderful representative come on to the podcast, talk to us about all the classes and therapies that they offer. It was two wonderful conversations. So I definitely direct you to both of those if you want more information, or just call their free quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Thank you again, tobacco-free Adagio Health, for your support. We're grateful for the support of UPMC for Life, a UPMC healthcare Medicare program. At UPMC Health Plan, their goal is to improve the health of their members. They can also help you make sense of Medicare, get the answers and information you need, such as how to choose the Medicare Advantage plan that's right for you. UPMC for Life offers a wide range of affordable Medicare Advantage plans, and you military veterans can save money and get more benefits with your Medicare plans. UPMC for Life has plans designed for veterans by veterans. The type of coverage you have from your service may help you decide which plan will be a good fit. If you have TRICARE for Life, UPMC for Life PPO Salute may be a good fit for you. You can view plan options, including their prescription drug coverage, compare costs, and learn about all the benefits you get when you choose UPMC for Life by going to upmchealthplan.com/Medicare. Thank you so much, UPMC for Life, for sponsoring the Scuttlebutt.